afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 79th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Karam Durda. Born into Turkish parents and raised in Pakistan, he came to the United States to study and ended up with a bachelor's degree in applied physics from St. John's University in Minnesota and a master's degree in mechanical engineering from UNH. Presently, he's the chief executive officer of an innovative Maine business called Biovation in Booth Bay, Maine. Welcome, Karam.
Welcome. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Delightful to have you here today. I first saw you when you were a keynote speaker, and I thought, oh, wow, this could be a very lively interview. And you just said yes.
I'm all about liveliness.
Maybe it was your past as a DJ on your college radio station.
Indeed, it could have been. All the shenanigans we were involved with, yes.
So let's go back to the beginning. You were born to Turkish parents. Were you not born in Turkey?
No, I was born in Karachi, Pakistan. My father was an architect, engineer. My mother is an archaeologist. My father saw an ad in the paper when he was working in Libya about coming to Pakistan and building the country. The ad was by the government of Pakistan, because in 63 they got independent in 47. So my father said, "That sounds good. Let's go." He went back to my mother and said, "We're going to Pakistan." My mother said, "Why are we going to Pakistan?" I said, "Well, it sounds like an adventure." So they went, loved it, and I was born in 69, conceived in East Pakistan.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good to know.
So it's these little details. And so my sister, so we were born and raised in Pakistan. But, there's a little Turkish community, obviously. So I'm trilingual, fortunate enough to be.
English.
English, Urdu, and Turkish.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you just have one sister?
One sister. She's married to a New Zealander, and they live in Australia. And my brother-in-law, long story short, but he's actually got three stepmothers. And so one is from Russia, another one is Danish, another one was a New Zealander. So his family's even more hybrid muttish than mine.
It would kind of be fun to take a world map and plot your family's location.
Yeah. We've sort of spread out quite a bit. Yeah. Not intentionally, I think. But
so, what was life like in Pakistan when you were a boy? What kinds of things were you doing for fun as a kid?
I suspect, like most boys, it was a beautiful childhood. I mean, it's fairly nutty over there. Life tends to have a sort of grind. But I was very fortunate. I went to a British school. They thought I was smart enough to attend there. So I had a whole sort of a economic stratification of friends, ranging from people who were who were from the government minister side, who bribed their way in, to the industrialist kids, to middle class, to lower middle class. So, and a lot of running around, doing stupid stuff, jumping from roofs and surviving. played a lot of cricket, a lot of field hockey, because those are the two national sports in Pakistan. My mother used to say, just go out and play. And so in the summers, we used to go out at 8 o'clock in the morning and probably come back 7 at night. I mean, we were out. I used to take public transportation starting when I was 9 years old. So I used to take the taxis or the rickshaws or the buses where you're hanging from the rooftops because they're, 300 people stuffed into a thing that shouldn't hold more than 75. And that was perfectly fine. That was the normal. If you got stranded somewhere, well, you got to figure out how to come home. I think life had a certain elemental quality to it. Obviously when you're growing up, no cell phones or anything. But I loved it. I have the extremest fondest memories of it. Go to the stadium, watch Imran Khan bowl to the, to Gavaskar and, Indians and, go places where I think even today, I think human beings would have a tough time going to, but we were kids, so we just went. It was a great adventure, honestly, it was. And then, obviously, during the days when we had school, you're in this sort of a cocooned environment where the Brits are teaching you with this air of, hierarchical authority, and you sort of rail against it. So, you get suspended enough times because you're sort of, railing against hierarchy. But on the other side, it was, when I show my kids my prefect's gown, my tie, my blazer, it's very sort of Hogwartish. And, I have the fondest stories from my school years. I mean, you know, 13 years in one establishment, sort of geared towards making some decent human being out of you, I think I hit the lottery of life on that. I mean, it's amazing.
Do you still keep in touch with some of the friends you made there?
I do. Very close ones. Yeah. I mean, we've known each other since, you know, kindergarten. Yeah, I do. There's probably four of them.
That's a pretty intense experience. Being with a small group for a long time.
Yeah, very, very. And, you know, you have the people that are all, you know, going nutty on Facebook, which I don't. So I keep in touch with them once a year. But, especially with the country the way it is now. So we find ourselves sort of on the sort of the outlier of sanity. So
Of Pakistan?
Yeah, Pakistan, mm-hmm. Yeah. Not that Turkey's any better. We have this despot, idiot. Actually, the elections are today, so let's see. I find myself curiously sort of being part of two cultures which are always in the news these days. You know, 20 years ago, we were in the backwater of news. Nobody cared. Now it's like we're on the news all the time.
So. Both Turkey and Pakistan.
Yeah.
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 When you were a kid, did you do things that made people think you might be an engineer one day when you grew up? Did you play with erector sets and chemistry?
Not really, but my father, he was an engineer. He was also an architect, obviously. But so I worked in a car garage for three summers in a row, which is an interesting experience because, you learn how to work with your hands. But when you're, sucking gasoline from a gas tank, it gives you another new color in life. And when you have
psychedelic colors,
exactly. And then when you have a good number of people, sort of experiencing the other side of smoking habits, it gives you a sense of what I would call the general mass of humanity lives like, which is, there's a day to day struggle for life, and I don't think I'll ever forget that. I used to walk there. You're working in the most atrocious conditions. I mean, we're not talking like a regular garage. You're talking a garage where to hoist the engine out, you're doing it pure grunt force.
Leaning over a car.
And there's no crane or anything. There's a sort of this, you got the chains, you got a couple of pulleys, and you got, six 12-year-old kids yanking this thing out. And, getting hurt, not a problem. There's always another one behind you. So for me, I think that was very formative because I learned what it means how to work. And I learned what it means to trust yourself. And I learned what it means that at the end of the day, you do have a certain obligation, a certain sense of responsibility towards being a good human being. But erector sets and stuff, I had my Lego set, which I destroyed. I pretty much summarily killed a lot of stuff. Broke a lot of windows because I was trying to do stupid stuff, come up with the next best thing to launch a rocket from inside the house. all that stuff. But I don't think engineering, you couldn't tell, Kerem is going to become an engineer. Other than, culturally speaking, you tend to fall into certain categories there. You doctor, engineer, lawyer, accountant. And I sort of fell into that engineer bucket. Fairly early on, there was expectation kind of stuff, but
is that what brought you to the United States? A pursuit of that?
In Pakistan, so the British school, which is called Karachi Grammar School, you're sort of geared towards either having your college experience be in the United States, the Ivy Leagues, or go to the UK, or do something in Pakistan. And, the school is extremely well known. Getting perfect scores in SATs, they're sort of like a walk in the park. Getting, 4.0 GPAs, there's not one person who gets that. There's like eight or nine of them. So you're laser beam focused on escaping the sort of the orbit of Pakistan and going into the United States for most of us. And part of it is, in my day, you have this sort of this cultural, what I would call, attunement, right? You watch TV shows, so you think everything is sort of, like Dallas. There are these rich people, you're driving fancy cars, fair amount of drama, but, you always get on top and make it big. These are, now, keep in mind, these are the 80s. So then you listen to music, you know, you've got the hair metal band thing going, you got the new wave thing going, you think, ah, this is the good life. You know, the United States is full of this stuff. And so there's this call of the siren, because life in Pakistan is sort of pedantic, you know, when you're a 17-year-old. But the life in the United States, that is sort of like Alice in Wonderland time. And so, yeah, so I've sort of progressed in that direction. We all did, right? Like lemmings, we all sort of progress in that direction. So there was no real intent to say, I'm going to do engineering in the United States. There was more of, I want to go to the United States because that's the coolest place to be, you know?
Yeah, and you picked the coolest place to be. You picked Minnesota.
Yeah, that was complete fluke. That was a complete fluke. Complete fluke. You know, so I've gone to a bunch of Ivy Leagues, but I didn't get a scholarship. And you need a scholarship to go to college. And so I couldn't make it in the fall semester. So I go to the consulate, the American consulate in Pakistan, which has later got bombed out many times over. And so the librarian, they say, go to Peterson's Guide of Colleges and, you know, pick something. And, you know, going to the college guide, I picked three colleges, and one of them happened to be St. John's. I send them my transcript, bunch of letters, and then, I don't know, 2 months later, I get this telegram saying, January 25th, we expect you here, half room and board, the other half, you can work as many jobs as you can. I was like, sounds good. Hey, let's go. So my father gave me a couple $100, one-way ticket. He said, go.
Good luck, honey.
Good luck. My mother was losing it. So when is my son going to come home? My father's like, whenever he figures it out. And that's how I ended up there. I had never seen snow before. I didn't know it was an all-Catholic, all-male establishment. I had no idea. I didn't even know where Minneapolis was on the map. Let alone, I didn't even know Minnesota was a state. I mean, what's Minnesota?
You know? I'm just delighted by the courage it takes and the pluck it takes. I think you almost have to be 18 to make a jump.
Yeah,
like
I
that.
Don't. Yeah, between the call of this, you know, the cool life and being completely, how should I say, veiled into, you know, thinking that you can do these crazy stuff. Yeah, you just sit on a plane and you go. And my plane was Gulf Air, which doesn't even exist anymore. So, yeah, Gulf Air was responsible. Actually, the funniest part is I got into Newark. Actually, I got into JFK, so I had to catch a plane from Newark. I didn't even realize that. So the guy says, you got to go to Newark. And I said, well, I'll just take the bus. And he said, you can't take a bus from here to Newark. I said, well, okay, I'll take the taxi. No, you can't do that. I said, I'll take the railway. He said, what railway? It was extremely sweet of him. He said, well, you know, we'll have to reroute you because you need to get to Newark right now. I said, okay. So they rerouted me and all that stuff. Very kind of them. So the night over, I actually stayed in New York without even realizing they gave me a voucher at the Four Seasons, which was interesting, which I didn't realize. Welcome to America. But they thought I was a homeless bum because, you know, I didn't have proper clothes. I barely had a jacket on. I was sort of bedraggled, one suitcase kind of stuff.
And January in Minnesota is like 20 below.
Yeah, I was just not. I just had a pair of sneakers. I didn't even know what boots were. So
wow, you found out pretty fast though, didn't you?
I did.
So you had said earlier when we were talking about this that you were the very first Muslim to ever go to a Catholic institution, St. John's University.
That's what
Minnesota.
They said, yeah.
And I wonder if you experienced any racism or othering there?
I don't think that racism, I think it was mostly ignorance, right? So it sort of translates to racism in different ways, but there was a general sense of, you know, sort of ignorance because, you know, Minnesota is in those days fairly whitish. And so you have this kid who's sort of from a completely different place. So, you know, you get the resident questions of, did you just have camels or did you just ride donkeys? Do you know what a television is? Do you know what a car is? You know, that kind of stuff, which you sort of have, you know, when you're 18, you also rail against that a little bit. And then you sort of become loud and then you become angry. And then you get more, you become more subject to what I would call the inability of the human being to really understand where you're from. And sometimes, yeah, that does get to be racist. I don't know, the first Gulf War was on the tail end of, you know, obviously when I was graduating. So, you know, fair amount of ignorant hatred, fair amount. of that because you're from the Middle East, and you know, I was in those days very vociferously vocal about my political leanings. So yeah, I've been subject to that, sure. People spit at you, people say enormously stupid stuff.
Does that happen still now in Maine, all these years later?
Well, yes, it does. It's happened to me on and off, not in the recent past, but happened several years ago. I'm a huge soccer guy, right? So I'm playing soccer, and you know, people sometimes say some of the most stupid stuff, stupid stuff, racist. And for example, somebody called me a wetback, and I said, well, there's two issues with that. One, you got the wrong geography. I'm not. I have nothing to do with being from South America or Latin America or Central America. So you're stupid in that regard. Second, why would you say something like that, right? And after that, I proceeded to grab the guy by the throat and, you know, became physical with him, which is not something I'm enormously proud of. But, you know, so your blood boils when somebody does that to you. It just so happens that my team, you know, had people from Colombia, Venezuela. So, you know, it's the stupidest thing to say to somebody on that team. The referee is from Rwanda. You know, I mean, so clearly the guy didn't think this through because he got thrown out. But, yeah, it happens. It happens more often than I think people would think it does.
Yeah. I think so, too.
Yeah.
You're listening to WMPG, that's Southern Maine Community Radio. We're broadcasting from USM. I'm Kate Manahan, and this is New Mainers Speak. If you're just joining us, welcome. My guest today is Karem Durda, a man from many places and a man with many talents. He's a speaker, a writer, a CEO, a father, a husband, and a volunteer. So you grew up in Pakistan, born to Turkish parents, and I'm wondering, in what ways is it different for you being a father here in Maine than if you were raising your kids in Pakistan? Do you ever think about that, if you weren't here?
I do. I think we're enormously lucky. Enormously lucky. You know, we don't have to worry about hot and cold water. We don't have to worry about power. I mean, my day, you know, we got water, for an hour every 3 days.
Cold water.
Cold water. Yeah, we don't have any hot water. Power used to go out, what they call rolling load shedding, right? So power used to go out every 2 days for a certain number of hours, and it's gotten progressively worse now. So the whole idea of being a father to kids within that context, I say to them that they have been gifted with certain things that they will never, ever fully realize how lucky they are. They can realize how fortunate they are by, you know, seeing how that part of the world has to grind through life. And they've been fortunate. They've been to Turkey. They haven't been to Pakistan yet, but one day they will. But what I think about is, you know, the small stuff, right? So I can trust them to get on a bus and they go to school and they come back.
A bus is only 75 people, not
350. Not, so yeah, Pakistan, fairly different, right? If I think that they have opportunities, they have more opportunities than they could shake a stick at, whereas in Pakistan, you know, unless you're one of the elite, then you don't. The whole idea of safety, security, the ability for them to actualize their own dreams in Pakistan, it's fairly limited. And if you're born into the lower middle class or the lower class, if you're obviously born to the people who do have the money and the power, it's a little bit different.
Is that a 10% kind of thing?
It's much less than that.
Yeah.
Much less than that. It's a very large country, but so I do worry about how lucky they are, or how lucky I am to be a parent over here, and I don't have to necessarily worry about the fight every day. I don't.
Move up Maslow's hierarchy of
needs,
right? And address.
Yeah, and they can, you know, the whole idea of they can do whatever they want is very much alive and well in the United States. Not much so back there.
Mm-hmm. And you have been doing exactly what you want, it seems. You are now the chief executive officer of BioVations in Booth Bay, Maine. And I wondered if you could tell me about your company and what you do, what you make. what it's like being a CEO.
What it's like being a CEO. So I've been very fortunate that I've you know, run a company or two. I've been successful at it, and I also screwed up plenty of times. So you tend to learn at least the right questions to ask. On this company, BioVations, we take a plastic that comes from cornstarch. So it's a completely biocompostable, biodegradable plastic. And we make fabric out of it. And the way we make fabric out of it is through a fairly involved, very niche, intellectually patent-protected process. And in the fabric, we can put certain kind of chemistries that do certain things that are very application-specific. So we have a set of products for the healthcare market. We have a set of products for, like, the Department of Defense. And then we have a certain set of products for the industrial, what we call the raw goods market. We're one of the very few that who do what we do. It's extremely hard what we do. But we also have a niche. So enables us to find a home in a fairly, what I would call, aggressive and crowded marketplace. But in terms of, at the end of the day, we have to solve problems and issues for the customer. And that ranges through an entire spectrum, especially, say, on the healthcare side. So we have this fabric that, for example, will be a barrier between the patient and hospital-acquired infections. So we're trying to do something that has some relevance to helping human beings. Another one, for example, what we did for the DoD, we made this fabric that will dry out wet combat boots or any kind of wet boots out on their mission patrols in 4 hours, 4 to 6 hours, if they have wet sopping combat boots, because otherwise their feet get blistery, then they get foot rot and all that stuff. So, and we're doing this with something that is completely biodegradable, biocompostable.
That has to feel good.
It does feel good. You know, a fair amount of stress and pressure, too, because you have to make money at it.
Yeah, so you're out there making money and being a CEO and solving real problems in the world, and you also find time to serve on boards. Can you tell us about some of the boards you've served on?
I do. Yeah, that's sort of like a calling in life for me. Way to give back. I think we all have to give back or keep on giving forward. Maybe not. Yeah. So I was the chair of the USM College of Science and Technology and Health Board. I was a member of Live360, which is an organization devoted to helping nonprofits with operational and strategic and tactical questions. I've been on certain for-profit boards, corporate boards. I've been on other boards. For example, we built playgrounds in Haiti and Afghanistan, which is still ongoing. I've been on boards where, for example, we help kids understand the value of STEM education and so on and so forth. So yeah, I do that a lot, and I have to be careful because sometimes you end up spending a lot of time doing that, and then you forget that you have certain other obligations in life. I would highly urge people to do that, especially if you've been blessed with the good life. Then you need to do that because nonprofits always need help.
Would you suggest that for immigrants as well as?
I would very much so, because I think there's a need to have that voice be part of the conversation in Maine. Very much so. I think that's one way to not just elucidate or articulate one's value as new Mainer, but it's another way to create that bridge, that understanding, which sometimes is lacking, given everybody has this sort of day-to-day life thing going on. But when you're serving on a board, the way human beings react to one another or relate to one another is significantly different than they do in a professional environment. And I think that just sort of aids in sort of this knitting the fabric of Maine, I think.
I think so, too. And I think it gives people who have had professional lives elsewhere in the world an opportunity to give it a professional level in their new communities, even if they may not be credentialed.
Oh, yeah. The whole idea of credentialing is a red herring when people use that as a filter to not get involved or not get people involved. The credentialing is very sort of relativistic, right? So you may be a lawyer in Rwanda or Burundi or Turkey or Pakistan. Doesn't mean that you can't be a lawyer here. Just means that you have to get the necessary certifications, but it doesn't stop you from speaking on legal matters. And I think there's this sort of the instinctive, what I would call, barrier that is presented to the immigrants coming over as, oh, you're not credentialed, so, you know, that's okay if you want to go and change bedsheets at a local motel, which I think is complete, well, I can't say it on radio, but that is, you know, that is borderline, not just stupid, but it's racist. So the conversation needs to be, oh, so you were credentialed there. How can we give you the tools and the measures to see if you can get the equivalent stuff over here as you are contributing? And so that there is a transference or there's a transition without waiting for 3, 4, 5 years. Because, you know, these human beings have an incredible amount of skill sets. So why do they need to wait necessarily for that, right? So yeah. It's arbitrary sort of hurdles.
Right. And so perhaps board work would be a way to connect with a professional community while Correct. You're retooling.
Correct. Yeah.
I understand you're a published poet and essayist and editor of Literary Magazine. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that and also in so doing share with us what you think is beautiful.
Oh, gosh. So, you know, so the Turks and Pakistanis, right? So we have this massive oral tradition of poetry, right? Poetry is part of us. School, college, I mean, it's just massively, massively in our head. And, you know, you say it out loud. It's part of your vernacular. I embarrass my kids off quite a bit. I embarrass my dear wife quite a bit by doing this, but it's just a way of life. And I think I'm gifted with the stuff that people call hot air, but in our cultures, it's called passion. So yeah, so I've written, I write quite a bit. It's one way to express things that are maybe inexpressible, right? So what do I think is beautiful? Within the recent past, I can see what is beautiful, right? So I think the movie Interstellar is enormously beautiful. I urge everybody to watch it. I think the Grand Tetons and Zion are incredibly beautiful. I think the struggle that the immigrants go through, not just to come to Maine, just to come to this country, right? And their enormous fortitude and belief in themselves, it is enormously beautiful. I think Turkey scoring that goal in the 89th minute against Iceland with 10 men down to be able to go to Euro 2016, enormously beautiful. I think when you run and you run and you run and it becomes, when your breathing is no longer something you're thinking of, but you're just running, is enormously beautiful. And I'm a runner, so I tend to think that. But I think it's incumbent upon a lot of us, if not every one of us, to just think of what is really beautiful. Because I think if you can do that, I think it sort of lends itself to having some amount of meaning in one's life. For example, this morning, you know, we were having breakfast. It was enormously beautiful, just sort of the family all together and just sort of razzing each other. I think that's enormously, enormously beautiful. My wife and my kids are razzing on me. Because there's love, right?
Yes.
There's love. And I think it's something as elemental as love is enormously beautiful.
And you're collecting it and holding it and cherishing it.
So I do.
It's yours to keep.
Yeah, I do. And then I pontificate on that, on, you know, by singing out loud songs and poems. Yeah.
If there were more time. Kerem, thank you so much for coming on New Mainers Speak today. In so many ways, you are a model citizen. And it's been my sincere pleasure to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, Kerem Durda. We will close today's program with a song our former DJ has chosen for us. Can you tell us why you chose this song real quickly?
Well, the reason I chose is because I'm a massive U2 fan. I've always been since the day these guys were created. And if you think of the madness in Pakistan when you're a kid and you have U2, and it really was something we listened to and thought, you know, there is some grace and love and light to this life we are living as 16, 17-year-olds. So yeah, they're enormously close to me. So I chose this one because it tells me what it's all about.
Ultraviolet, you know. Or Light My Way.
Sometimes I feel like I don't know. Sometimes I feel like checking out. I wanna get it right. Can't always be strong. Love, it won't be long. Trash, you make me feel pain. I'm in the black, can't see or be seen. Baby,